situation and choice in the UK. Time to look now at the sort of harnessing the power of the informal economy, and I don't know if that means that it then becomes part of the formal economy. Maybe Robert will address that. Robert Neuwirth is an author and a journalist, and please welcome him to the session this afternoon.
Thanks. I guess I'd sum up what I want to say by saying that in his really perceptive and moving talk last night, Michael Marmot called some of the communities that we're all concerned about and that I'm going to talk about hellholes. And I'm here to make the case for hellholes. So the organizers of the conference created a great title for my talk, and last night at about midnight, I decided I wanted to change the title for the talk. So I'm calling it Who's Afraid of the Informal Economy? And because there's a policy dimension to what our panel is all about, I think the real import of my talk is contained in the first two slides and what you think of the first two slides. So this is Oshodi Market in Lagos, Nigeria, 2 years ago. Amazing, cacophonous, horrendous, wonderful, lots of hyper-entrepreneurial activity going on. And this is Oshodi Market today. Government policy is that street trading is bad. Street trading is illegal. They've already arrested 5,000 street traders. There's no due process. They just came in and wiped the market out. So I'm basically going to argue that this is not the way to go. You may disagree with me. But that government needs to engage the informal economy and engage squatters in squatter communities. So let me go through the statistics here. Rural to urban migration. So the world's cities are growing by 200,000 people a day, which is 1.4 million a week, 70 million a year, or going the other direction, it's 130 people every minute or two every second. And what that has meant is that we have a billion squatters in the world today, almost, which is almost one in six people on the planet. By 2030, the statistics seem to show we'll have 2 billion, which will be one in four. And halfway through this century, there'll be 3 billion squatters, and it'll be a third of the people on Earth. Now, we know what we need to do about this. We need to build. And what we need to build is 35 million units a year. And if you, again, do the math, 96,000 homes a day, 4,000 every hour, 66 a minute, or one every second. And I think you'll all probably agree with me, but maybe I'll get some fight on this, that no government, no developer can build one house a second around the world. It's just not possible. The only people who are going to do it are the people who are doing it, which is the squatters in these communities. So there's no way around that. It is just a reality. And for the informal economy, the statistic is that half the workers of the world right now, that's 1.8 billion people, are in the informal economy, not the formal economy. Do we all know what the informal economy is? Businesses that fly under the radar, don't register, don't get regulated, most often don't pay taxes, that kind of stuff. In another 20 years, it'll probably be two-thirds of the world's workforce. And in a place like Lagos, Nigeria, 80% of the working people are working informally. So what that says to me is it makes no sense to even make these kinds of differentiations. If 80% of the people in the city are employed informally, then it makes no sense to talk about the formal economy as some sort of a solution. The informal economy is the solution. It's the economy of full employment. So, let's see. What do we have? We have squatter communities are growing faster than legal areas. The informal economy is growing faster than the formal, which irks a lot of people because rationality seems to be irrational. And the answer, it's kind of reductivist, is that we have to get used to it because that's what's happening in the world. So, is this a bad thing? Well, it's always been like this in some way. This is from London in 1675. Population 350,000, 18,000 peddlers and hawkers on the street. That's 5% of the population of the city. By some accounts, they were the people that first started the rebuilding of the city after the Great Fire of London, which was in 1666. So it's always been around. And you can see here's a Hong Kong street market from 1902, not very different from a street market in the Lower East Side of New York in the same year, and not all that different from Idumota in Lagos, Nigeria, and certainly not all that different from, this is the market at Rua 25 de Março in São Paulo, Brazil. Street markets have always existed. They're part of the economy, and they exist all over the world, and so it's a question of how to harness them. Mixing in squatter communities. The way a squatter community develops is it starts like this. Worst possible house you could imagine. And this is in Kibera in Nairobi, Kenya. And give it a little bit of time, and it'll become like this, which is in Rocinha in Rio de Janeiro, the largest favela in Rio, or one of the largest at this point. And that won't stay that way for long, because it will soon become like this. This is Sultanbeyli in Istanbul, Turkey, and that's my friend Süleyman Akaya. And he built that house with his father, and you can see it's better. It's new materials on the roof instead of scavenged materials on the roof. Pretty snug little place, but I can guarantee you, I haven't been back, but I can guarantee you it doesn't look like that anymore. Because right across the street, it looks like this. The squatters have recognized that there's an opportunity to tear down their little one-family houses and build something that they can rent out and make some money on, and they build them with spare apartments. So you can see the green one in the center is vacant at the top, and as more people move in from the rural area, someone will rent that space, and they'll pop windows in it, and they'll rent it. And it even, this is the way Rocinha in Rio develops. One house built on top of another. Someone builds a floor or two and sells the roof rights to a friend who builds a floor or two on top of that, and it sort of twists up in the air like a modern-day Renaissance hill town. So, and it even becomes like this. This is also in Istanbul in Sultanbeyli, a kind of suburban model of squatter development. Now, we have to understand these communities as economically vibrant. And this looks like a horrific sort of scene of raw sewage. And indeed, it is a horrific scene of raw sewage in Kibera and Nairobi. But in reality, that little building on the right-hand side says hotel, right? Hotels in post-colonial British reality are restaurants. And that's a butcher shop and restaurant. And all through the community, you find businesses. There's along the train line, people selling mitumba, which is used clothing. And this is a main drag in Kibera. And if you look at it, just count the number of businesses on that street. Bars and health clinics and soda distributors and stores of all types. And this goes on for miles and miles, kilometers and kilometers throughout the community. So these are not communities without entrepreneurial activity. Similarly, in Lagos, this is in Makoko, which is one of the worst lagoon-side squatter communities. This is a store, because when you live on the water, the goods have to come to you. You don't go to the goods. And so this lady is paddling around the community selling cassava and other starches that people use to cook. And this is a multinational business also in Makoko, because there's a fish smokehouse. She gets the wood from the sawmills that are right nearby in Ebute Meta. And I asked her where the fish came from, and it comes from Europe. So the fish is imported from Europe into the worst slum, in quotes, in Nigeria, and smoked and then sold on the streets. This is a hugely complex marketplace. This is the Olusosun garbage dump in Lagos. And these are the dump scavengers who work there. And I know about this place because I got to know this guy. And this is Andrew Saboru. And Andrew, he started out as a scavenger And he worked as a scavenger for 16 years. So he was one of the guys in the picture previously. And after 16 years, he got a gig being what's called a contract scaler, which is he was paid by someone else to walk around with the scale and weigh all the stuff that his fellow scavengers picked up, and then he got a percentage based on that. And he saved enough money to turn himself into a scrap dealer. That's his little depot behind him. And now he pays the scavengers for the material that he gathers, and then he sells it directly to the recyclers. And this is not a place for, you know, microcredit per se, because his income is beyond that. He makes three times the governmentally mandated minimum wage every month. His working capital is 100,000 naira, which is $600 to $700. He needs to double that, triple that, quadruple that. That's what he wants to do. And so he's not looking for tiny incremental investment. He really needs to figure out how he's going to get real money. And he has a bank account. The problem is the banks won't lend him any money. So there has to be some way that the banks and him can communicate. And the informal even gets bigger, okay? And what's interesting to me is about this ad. The ad is for MTN, mobile phones. And the mobile phone industry is really fascinating in Nigeria. When MTN came into the country, they're a South African firm. They're active in 23 countries throughout Africa and the Middle East. They wanted an American, Canadian, UK-style business. Stores where they would sell their phones, and you would buy a monthly plan, and it would be expensive. And the business crashed and burned because no one wanted to do that. So they retooled and came back with a new model, which is they don't sell you phones. They sell you airtime, recharge cards. And where are the recharge cards sold? They're sold on little umbrella stands run by informal merchants on the side of the road or by hawkers who sell the cards in the middle of traffic. So this major multinational, which is highly profitable, it now has 45% market share in Nigeria, and Nigeria is the largest country in Africa and the fastest growing mobile phone market in Africa. So this major multinational is making all its money by selling airtime in the informal economy. And the phones also come into the country through the informal economy. They come from here. This is the Guangzhou Dashato used mobile phone market in Guangzhou, China. And Nigerians and people from all over Africa voyage to China to buy mobile phones, which they import back to their countries. They're actually not used mobile phones. They're actually pirated brand names, mostly. But fairly high quality, and the price is right for what the people want. And, you know, you see those guys carrying the boxes, and when you get outside, they're going to Eddie in Lagos. And it's all traveling informally. They're not paying taxes on this. They're not paying customs duty on it. And it's a completely cash business. And it's a big business. The first Nigerian that I met in the Guangzhou Dashato market was Chief Arthur Okafor. And I ran into him when he was finishing all his purchases, and they were wrapping all these styrofoam crates in packing tape. And he was really happy, and he said to me, "You know how much money I came here with?" I didn't know. And he said, $40,000. And you know how much I'm going home with? And he just raised his hands, like sprinkling fairy dust in the air. It's big business. And he's a small player in the mobile phone market. So the informal economy has scaled up into global trade. And there has to be ways for governments to encourage this and work with it. Now, there's another portion of the informal economy, and in squatter communities, you can look at this and you can say, my God, they're stealing electricity. And they are stealing electricity. This happens to be in Hocinha in Rio de Janeiro. One of the things they can do with stealing electricity is that they can then steal water, because they can run pumps and steal, tap into the water pipes and pump water up the hill into tanks on everyone's roof so that they have water. So for the people who are caring about pure and safe water, this is actually a really efficient way of getting it. Now, I look at the, you know, Proudhon said property is robbery, and Andre Gorz said robbery is poetry. So this is a kind of poetic image to me. But there's also a serious side to it, which is that having electricity when you live in a wood shack can be your best way of preventing your community from burning down. But the police in South Africa have been arresting people for connecting themselves to the electrical grid. Yet, at the same time, the police have not arrested anyone who's been attacking the squatters in the exact same community where they are arresting the people who are stealing electricity. So there have to be middle grounds. And Rio has developed something like that, where they have a nonprofit that the power company set up to work with the squatters to get them wired and to take meters. And I can tell you, everywhere in the world, the squatters are willing to take meters. They understand that electricity is not free. They want service that can run an appliance, that can run a radio. They want service that isn't just one feeble light bulb. And they're willing to pay for it. So it's just a question of whether governments are willing to work with these so-called criminals. So the solution is to work with people. This is Geeta Jiwa. She lived on a median strip in Goregaon in Mumbai, India. And every time I passed by, her house got smaller and smaller and smaller because the government would come and knock it down and she would build it up. So it started up here, and by the time I left, it was, you know, you couldn't stand up in it. I'm not making an argument that people should be allowed to live on median strips of highways. I'm just making an argument that the solution is not to just keep demolishing her house. The solution is to figure out how to work with her. This is my friend Zezinho in Rocinha in Rio de Janeiro. And again, he's a fruit merchant. He came there when he was 7. He had a push cart initially and just carried fruit up and down the hill. And now he has a store and he makes enough money. Those are his kids who share the same body type. And he sends them to private school. He makes enough money to send them to private school because he knows that in order to get a really good education, there is public education in Brazil, but to get the really good education where you can pass the vestibular and get into free university, you need to go to private school. And so he sends his kids to private school. So I guess what I'm saying is that we got to stop thinking about these things as other. Stop thinking about the informal economy as some evil and other and criminal thing. Stop thinking of squatters as something evil and other and criminal, and start figuring out how to work with them. Because the informal economy and the squatter communities, they're the place where everyone gets housed, and it's the economy of full employment. And that's why it sort of made sense when I went to the U.S.-Mexico border that I saw this sign. And so if you want to eat, don't come to the United States. But otherwise, so the informal economy creates the possibility for people to have jobs, to have food, to support their families, and to ultimately function as productive citizens in society. It's just we who don't want to think about it that way. So I think we have to find all these in-between steps where we can work with squatters, work with squatter communities, and work with the informal economy, and that's the way forward to improve health outcomes, to improve economic outcomes, and to make the world a more just place. And so I'll end there. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Robert.